Second level of understanding to judgment is complex. It's the whole area of questions for reflection, marshaling and weighing evidence, and reflective insight, grasping the sufficiency of the evidence for a prospective judgment for saying yes or no. All of that is in between understanding and judgment. So again, the question for reflection, is this the case? Is this so? Marshaling and weighing the evidence, it's a metaphor. And reflective insight, grasping the sufficiency of the evidence for a prospective judgment, for saying yes or no. And then the judgment is just the yes or no that comes out of that. The proximate ground of judgment, then, is another kind of insight, the reflective insight that grasps the sufficiency of the evidence for a prospective judgment. To pronounce judgment without that reflective grasp is merely to guess. That's John's point earlier about that sometimes it's reasonable not to judge. But once that grasp has occurred, to refuse to judge is just silly. Or it may be based in psychological motivation, being afraid or whatever. It's not being reasonable in this sense. So the issue here is, what is sufficient evidence? What is it to grasp the sufficiency of evidence? How do I know in my own cognitional process, in something that I can identify in the experience, the consciousness of being a knower, how do I know when I've got to the point where the evidence is sufficient? What are the scales on which evidence is weighed? What weight must evidence have if one is to pronounce a yes or no? These are very important questions, and they're important questions not just for us as knowers, but for integrity as human beings. Okay. What is it to take responsibility for a judgment? The general statement, and now this doesn't help much yet, because it's going to sound quite abstract, and he hasn't yet gotten into the experience of it, but the general statement is the following from page 305. To grasp evidence as sufficient for a prospective judgment is to grasp the prospective judgment as virtually unconditioned. Now, Gordon Rickson wrote a paper a couple of years ago in which he suggested the term contingently unconditioned. And I think that's a better term than virtually unconditioned. Virtually unconditioned, for us in a computer age, sounds like virtual reality. And that's exactly what he's not talking about. Contingently unconditioned gives us exactly the sense of what he's talking about. That it doesn't have to be unconditioned, but in fact it is. And that's what contingent sort of communicates. Well, in fact, more than sort of communicates. So I like the expression. I like Rickson's suggestion that we've referred to this as the contingently unconditioned. The formally unconditioned has no conditions whatever. In the ontological order, none of us is formally unconditioned. Each one of us exists only because our parents met, fell in love, were married, and had us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. There are conditions for our existence. We do not have to exist. And if those conditions were not fulfilled, we would not be. So we are contingently unconditioned. It is true that we are. Each one of us is. But it doesn't have to be that way. We don't exist by necessity. Now, he'll argue in chapter 19 of the book that the only reality with no conditions whatever is God, who is formally unconditioned, or a necessary being in the traditional sense, in traditional terminology. But all of the conditions for our existence are fulfilled, and so while our existence is conditioned, it also is virtually or contingently unconditioned. It doesn't have to be, but in fact it is. And that's what is meant by the contingently unconditioned. There are conditions, but they are fulfilled. So that's in the ontological order. The contingently unconditioned is what de facto is, even though it doesn't have to be. So too in the epistemological order. The virtually or conditionally unconditioned has conditions, but we know what they are, and we grasp that they are fulfilled. We know what those conditions are, and we grasp that they're fulfilled. A virtually unconditioned or a contingently unconditioned involves three elements, namely, number one, a conditioned. Number two, a link between the conditioned and its conditions. And three, the fulfillment of the conditions. And all of that in cognitional process, in our experience as knowers. a conditioned. Is it so? The link between the conditioned and the conditions. Well, it is so if, and the fulfillment of the conditions, yeah, the if is realized. So hence, a prospective judgment will be virtually unconditioned, number one, if it is the conditioned, number two, if its conditions are known, and number three, if the conditions are fulfilled, and we know the conditions are fulfilled. So by the mere fact that a question for reflection has been put, the prospective judgment is a conditioned. So if you arrive at the formulation here at the level of understanding, let's say that you formulated a scientific law, the distance is proportional to the time squared, and you raise the question, is that true? By raising that question, you are acknowledging that it's conditioned, that you're not yet ready to make the judgment. It's just a possibility at that level. It's just hypothetical at that level. It might be the case. And you say, is it the case? And raising that question shows you that there are conditions that have to be fulfilled before you can assent to it. So the very fact that a question for reflection has been put makes it a condition. It stands in need of evidence sufficient for reasonable pronouncement. The function of reflective understanding, which is what takes place in here, in between there, is to meet the question for reflection by transforming the prospective judgment from the status of a conditioned to the status of a virtually or contingently unconditioned by grasping that there's enough evidence for saying yes to it. Okay. Reflective understanding effects this transformation by grasping the conditions of the conditioned and their fulfillment, grasping that. It's reflective understanding that grasps the conditions and their fulfillment. Another language for all of this can be found in the Grammar of Assent by John Henry Newman, which is where Lonergan got most of his position on reflective understanding and judgment. Reflective understanding is Newman's illative sense. In Newman's language, it's the illative sense that grasps that the evidence is in for the judgment. And I must affirm, if I'm to be authentic, a person of integrity, if the evidence is grasped is sufficient, there's no reason to reserve assent. So that's where he got it. He read Grammar of Assent 8 times in his philosophical studies as a young Jesuit, 1926 to 1928. So it probably had as profound an effect on his development as anything else that he ever did. So number 14, while the form of deductive inference, if A, then B, but A, therefore B, that form, it reveals the way in which a conclusion can be exhibited as a virtually unconditioned. So while that's the case, that's not the way we usually come to it. We don't employ syllogism very often. We don't employ that form very often. There's a grammatical mistake in my language here, so let me just say in the fourth line, after judgment, there should be a comma rather than a period, and the word but should be removed. So a comma rather than a period, then remove but. So while the form of deductive inference reveals the way in which a conclusion is exhibited as virtually unconditioned. So if I wanted to come back and explain to you, I could go into this. The way in which reflective insight grasps the pattern and the way in which by rational compulsion there follows the judgment, it reveals all of that. Still, deductive inference cannot be the basic case of judgment. And why? Because it starts out with a judgment. If A, then B is a judgment. Well, how did you get to that? There has to be something else, some other process that gets you there. So you can't say that we arrive at judgment by using judgments. How did you get to those? So, and especially if judgment is at the term of a cognitional process, you got to those by going through a process of experiencing and understanding. That's how we got to that. And you got to if A, then B by that. So that this can't be the basic, and in fact it isn't in our experience. Look at the example that he gives. That you leave your house in the morning and everything's tidy and you come home at night and there's smoke in the air and water on the floor and the windows are smashed and you say something happened. You don't go through this. Well, if there's smoke in the air and water on the floor and the windows are smashed, then something happened. But there's smoke in the air and you don't. That's not the process you use. You can use that to exhibit that conclusion if you want, but you arrive at that through some other process. You arrive at that through this experience and understanding and judging. That's how you get it. So logical inference does not answer the question, what is it to grasp sufficient evidence? For it presupposes other judgments to be true. So this judgment, that's the judgment that you're out for, but you're presupposing these two. And how did you get to those? The form of reflective insight lies rather in the fact that the link between conditioned and conditions and the fulfillment of conditions exist and are grasped in a more rudimentary state, somehow relying on what goes on here in this more rudimentary state before you get to any judgment at all. Before ever they are articulated in judgments. The remarkable fact, and that's his language, that's why I put it in quotes, the remarkable fact about reflective insight is that it can make use of these more rudimentary elements to reach the virtually unconditioned. And the remainder of the chapter shows how that happens in different cases. How this process, how it turns back on itself to make use of more rudimentary elements, to find in those elements the evidence for the judgment. Okay, so we'll take the cases. So again, this next, number 15 is still a general statement, and number 15 and 16 are still general statements, and then he goes into examples. So 15. Prior to statements or judgments, there are unanalyzed structures or procedures, just immanent and operative in the way we do things. Cognitional process, just the way we do things without reflecting on them, without analyzing them, that they're operative. And they are what link the conditioned with the fulfilling conditions. So, he does go right into an example right here. In the concrete judgment of fact, something happened. The fulfilling conditions are two sets of data at this level. My home as I left it in the morning and my home as I find it when I come home. Two sets of data. One remembered, this is what it looked like in the morning, and one currently experienced, this is what it looks like now. And so they are found on the first level, the level of presentations. The link between the conditioned judgment and the fulfilling conditions depends on the direct insight here that relates those two sets of data to the same set of things. This is my home. This is the same address. This is the same place. That's an insight. And so in the addition of a second level, so you've got the two sets of data, X and Y, the understanding that relates those to the same set of things. And then he says, this unanalyzed, spontaneous, pre-propositional structure of knowing change is what links the conditioned, something happened, with its fulfilling conditions. The link between something happened and the fulfilling conditions, the two sets of data, is a structure immanent and operative within me, within cognitional process. Within the dynamism of my own mind, within the dynamism of my own spirit. It's not a judgment. It's not a formulated set of concepts like a definition. It's simply the way we do things. There's a procedure that is immanent in us that enables us to move to judgment by exploiting the resources that are given to us at the level of experience and the level of insight. Procedure within the concept, within the cognitional field. That's a mistake. That should be cognitional field, not conceptual field. The three elements have been assembled. On the level of presentations, there are two sets of data. On the level of intelligence, there is an insight referring both sets to the same things. And when both levels are taken together, there's involved the notion of knowing change. And reflective understanding grasp all three together as a virtually unconditioned to ground the judgment something happened. Now he's analyzing out something here that you don't analyze out when you make the judgment something happened. He's analyzing it out. He's giving words to it. You just do it. It just happens. It's operative without being analyzed. You don't have to analyze the procedure in order to reach the judgment. He's analyzing it as a philosopher, trying to tell us what human knowing is. But we just know. We just do it. It's our way of doing things. And it gets us there. That's a simple example, obviously. It's one that shows that there's a more rudimentary process, that there's a way in which all of these elements come together to give the evidence for the judgment. And it would be foolish in a case like this not to say something happened. But what caused it is another question. Was it a fire? You know, was it a leak in the water pipes? Whatever. That's a further question. Did something happen? Yeah. That's virtually unconditional. All right. Next thing. Now, this is the crucial issue and something that can be hard to grasp because when you read it, it seems so simple, and yet the claim that it's making is anything but. How does one know whether the insight that is the pivot of this structure is correct? The insight that relates the two sets of data to the same set of things and uses all of that as the ground for the judgment. Insights are vulnerable when there are further questions to be asked on the same issue. But when there are no further questions, the insight is invulnerable. This is the experiential aspect of the whole thing. When, in fact, there are no further relevant questions. That's how I know whether the evidence is sufficient. When, in fact, there are no further relevant questions, the insight is invulnerable. The conditions for the prospective judgment are fulfilled when there are no further pertinent questions. It's as simple as that, and yet it's as existentially involving as that, because there's the profound question that I've got to ask of whether there are further questions or not, in any case. And that's what he goes into right away. It may be, of course, that I fail to allow the further questions to arise. Or it may be that I remain indecisive when, in fact, there are no further pertinent questions, for whatever reason, temperament, fear, whatever. But then what is at stake is not the laws of cognitive authenticity, but my fidelity to them. My authenticity, but not the laws of authenticity. One has to give the further questions a chance to arise. Good judgment on any insight has to rest on the previous acquisition of a large number of other related correct insights. There's the self-correcting process of learning that tends to the limit of familiarity in particular domains. There's the issue of my temperament, and I can deal with my temperament if it happens to be either rash or indecisive, and if people have pointed that out to me often enough, I might have a problem with rash judgment or with the fear of making judgments. So there's all of that, that's all at stake when you get to this level. Personal integrity as a cognitive being, okay? But the general form of the virtually unconditioned is the following. There occurs a reflective insight in which at once one grasps a conditioned, namely the prospective judgment, that a given direct or introspective insight at the level of understanding is correct. Secondly, a link between the conditioned and its conditions, and this on introspective analysis proves to be that an insight is correct if it is invulnerable, and it is invulnerable if there are no further pertinent questions. And thirdly, the fulfillment of the conditions, namely that the given insight does put an end to further pertinent questioning. Something happened, that's sure. He can judge that. Then he's got to go on and figure out what it was, and make further judgments. And that this occurs in a mind that's alert, familiar with the concrete situation, and intellectually in control of it, whatever language you want to use there. See Method and Theology 254, and this is across the board. He's not just referring to judgment here, but it applies here. The basic idea of the method we're trying to develop takes its stand on discovering what human authenticity is and showing how to appeal to it. It is not an infallible method, for we are easily unauthentic, and in the case of judgment, we can easily be rash or we can easily be fearful. But it is a powerful method for our deepest, that's a real mistake there, deep end, our deepest need and most prized achievement is authenticity. What is at stake when there is rashness or indecision, again, is not the laws of cognitive authenticity, but my fidelity to them. And some of the elements in such fidelity, I've gone through them already. You've got to give them a chance and so on. I guess I repeated myself, for I didn't even notice that. Number five, though, in common sense matters, and this is extremely important, I can consult others who may be more familiar with the particular situation than I am. And in scientific matters or philosophic matters or theological matters, I can consult those who know what they're talking about. These social components are emphasized in the sections on common sense judgments and scientific judgments, and then if you want to look ahead, you might look to pages 573 to 575, where he speaks very much in more detail about the social components of judgment. And I want to recommend the work of William Raig, who's a Jesuit at St. Louis University, who's done his main work in Jürgen Habermas. But he's got a book called Insight and Solidarity, where there's a very short section on Lonergan on judgment and Habermas's compliments to Lonergan on judgment. And there's an article by Raig in the book, which is in the Regis Library and over at the Lonergan Library as well. The book is called Communication and Lonergan. Edited by Thomas Farrell and Paul Suka. And the paper by Raig, I'm convinced, makes an advance in Lonergan's cognitional theory. And he appeals to Habermas in the paper to emphasize the social component in the movement to truth. That it's not, in many instances, and especially in the instances where the human complexity is involved, it is not a matter of just the single isolated individual, but it is rather a community enterprise. And it's a matter of discussion, communication, conversation, communicative action in Habermas's terms. I think he's absolutely right. And yet, Lonergan's general form is the correct form. Raig is emphasizing that. So he's taking over from Habermas the social component of the movement to truth, but also from Lonergan a more satisfactory account of truth itself than you can find in Habermas's consensus theory. I think there are difficulties with the consensus theory of truth, because it is possible that everybody's wrong. You know? And consensus theories of truth, many of them arise out of German idealism. And I think that they should always be reminded that consensus is what put Hitler in power, is the consensus of the nation. So you can't appeal to the consensus of the majority as your ultimate criterion for truth. You've got to have something else. And what it is the grasp of the contingently unconditioned. An entire culture can be wrong, deadly wrong, and that's part of what Raig is emphasizing over against Habermas. But what he's taking from Habermas and using to complement Lonergan is the social discourse, communicative discourse ethics context of arriving at truth. An entire culture can be deadly wrong in its most important judgments. The responsibility remains with you and me. And to anticipate it just a little bit, and this is my own language, the intelligent person who is not reasonable, got all kinds of insights, but is not reasonable, is attuned to, in love with, has an eros for his or her own intelligence. While the intelligent and reasonable person is attuned to, is in love with, and has an eros for the evil. It's a big difference. Okay, so I really want to point that Raig thing out, because I think Raig has made a distinct contribution to Lonergan's project by calling upon Habermas for the elucidation of the social context for arriving at judgment. but without taking anything away from Lonergan's structure and criteria for judgment itself.
Yes. You say in the work of William Ragg, they are made an intrinsic part of the human law of cognitional process. Are you talking about the social
components? I must have really been tired of the work. These social components are emphasized in the sections on common sense judgments and scientific judgments, and again, 573, 575. In the work of William Ragg, the social components are made an intrinsic part of the immanent law of cognitional process. That when we're moving from understanding to judgment, we should, on any complex matters, we should go into a community and it should become a part. That's Habermas's discourse ethics, you know, that, particularly if you're talking about the emergence of truth in human society, in human affairs, and so on.
Is that where Lonergan's talking about the self-correcting process of learning?
Yes.
And the way that Lonergan talked about it, it seemed to me that that's a kind of natural exigency that arises and makes its demands, that we are compelled to be in conversation with the community in terms of seeking out the evidence needed.
I think that's true, and he says it. I mean, it's clear that he says it right here, that I should check my judgments up with others, and so on and so on. But I'd like to give it more emphasis than he does, and I think the Habermas thing is very helpful, but Ragg really puts it up. There are some judgments that you probably are not going to arrive at unless it's out of conversation or discourse. That's the only way you'll get that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm very interested in your final sentence about the intelligent person who's not reasonable,
yeah,
who has an errors for their own intelligence. Could you give us an example of that or expand on that?
Well, I've known some people who would fit that.
Like a historical example.
Historical example.
Shrub.
Hmm?
A fellow named Shrub.
Shrub?
Yeah.
Who is Shrub?
George Bush.
That would require intelligence.
That would require
intelligence. Be in love with it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm thinking of personal examples, but I don't want to mention them.
I'm working on a paper on Simone Weil, and that's why I asked that.
Oh, I wouldn't put her in that category.
Okay.
She's so careful and strict with herself, isn't she?
I have theory that she idealized her own intelligence beyond reason.
Well, I haven't read that much of her, but I think of her as, I think of the mystical aspects. So. So I don't know, but I mean I think you know you get what I'm talking about, don't you?
I'm not completely sure. You mean somebody is so interested in their own ideas that they stick to their own idea and they won't see reasonably on their own idea, but that's not the same as their intelligence.
Well, it is. You see, I mean it's this level. Mm-hmm. It's understanding.
Yeah.
And they can have insight after insight after insight and spout them and so on and. But never take the time to validate.
Okay, so they're always stuck on the level of understanding.
They're stuck on the level. And they don't know being on the level of understanding. They know being at the level of judgment. We'll see that in chapter 12 in detail. Yes.
I think I heard you say once, Bob, that the possibility of talking about a social conversion as perhaps not an addition to the conversions, but are we moving to data that would help us to explore that?
Yeah, there's a social dimension to all of the dimensions of conversion that Lonergan speaks about that I think needs to be brought to the fore. And this would be the social dimension of intellectual conversion, and especially what Ragg is getting at here, appealing to open, honest communication and dialogue as you're striving to move towards truth. But the biggest, the prominent area where I was emphasizing it, I think, if I remember what you were talking about, would be the social dimension to moral conversion. That moral conversion as it's spoken of by Lonergan is this shift in the criterion of your decisions from satisfactions to values. And values are what carry you to self-transcendence. But then you've got to put that into the context of a scale of values, which is all social. You know, it's vital, social, cultural, personal, religious, but the whole thing is the ultimate, the bottom line is the equitable distribution of vital goods to the whole community. And that's what's setting the agenda for the whole scale of values. And if that's out, then everything else has got to change. You know? So there's a social context to moral conversion that I think should be highlighted. There's a social context to religious conversion. It all occurs within the within a community. It's always, you know, there's very few people for whom religious conversion happens the way it did with St. Paul on the road to Damascus. For most of us, it's something that grows out of the community, you know, and it's slow. It takes a long time, and so on. So there are those aspects. But this would be the social dimension to what he calls intellectual conversion.
I've thought about that difficulty of the emphasis perhaps not being as much brought to the fore, but my own response has been that somewhere along the way he has been helping us to focus so much on interiority and those operations that while he begins with the primordial intersubjectivity and somewhere that doesn't ever become suspended, that the interrelatedness
right.
is always.
Oh, I think there's no question
but it's,
that's the case. Yeah. And ultimately, it does come back to the subject in the sense mm-hmm. that each one of us is responsible for our own judgments. And that consensus is not, and this is the point that Reig is making over against Habermas, that consensus is not an adequate criterion for arriving at truth. A whole community can be wrong, or the majority. It still comes back to, and that's the value of Lonergan's thing, is that the criterion is found in this process. You know? But the issue that Reig is making is that an awful lot of what goes into that process is provided by the community in discourse. Data, insight, grasp, an atmosphere in which you can process all of this that's provided by the community. And without that, without the provision of the community's input and atmosphere created by the community for proceeding towards truth, we can't move. We need encouragement, we need challenge, we need data, we need affirmation, and that comes from others. It's not something that we can move towards. Anyway, that's a very important article, I recommend it highly. Not, and it's important in a sense. As I've said, and I put it in a footnote in one of my own articles, that it's not just a good article, it's a contribution to the very project of this book, to what I think what he's done in this article. He's contributing to filling out a cognitional theory. And Lonergan makes the point in chapter 11. This whole thing is subject to endless nuancing and further development, and that this is an indication or an instance of that. All right, then there's a whole issue about analogy and generalization, and especially in common sense. In science, it's easy to generalize because the data are controlled by experimentation. So similars are similarly understood. But when you're dealing with insights into concrete situations, the use of analogy and generalization is very precarious because situations can vary in very minute ways, and it makes it really dangerous to carry over judgments from one situation into another. So insights into a concrete situation presuppose a process of learning and the attainment of familiarity and mastery. Furthermore, the so-called analogous situation must really be similar. And how do we determine which differences are significant? In science, that's easy. The differences would be differences of color or shape or whatever. But in common sense, in concrete situations of human living, differences can be very subtle. The precariousness, however, he says, of analogy and generalization is compensated for by the collaboration, and here we are again at the communal, right? The collaboration in the process of learning known as common sense, provided common sense remains within its limited domain and provided it's not affected by bias. Two big provisions. There does exist a determinate field or domain of ordinary description. Its defining or formal viewpoint is the thing as related to us as it enters into the concerns of human beings. Its object is what is to be known by concrete judgments of fact, by judgments on the correctness of insights into concrete situations, by concrete analogies and generalizations, and by the collaboration of common sense. It is as much an object of knowledge as any other, for it is reached by beginning from the level of presentations, by advancing through inquiry, insights, and formulation, by culminating in the critical inquiry and reflective understanding, the grasp of the unconditioned, the rationally compelled pronouncement of judgment. So if I have an insight into a concrete situation, my living situation, my family, whatever, okay, that's as much an object of knowledge as the law of falling bodies, because it's reached by this same process of experiencing, understanding, and judging. But what he's emphasizing, too, is the difficulty of moving by analogy, like from one family to another. They're all different differences. The collaboration includes belief, and that's a topic of the analysis of belief will come up later on in the book. In principle, science and common sense cannot conflict, because they're both valid forms of knowing. But in fact, they do conflict unless you get them sort of differentiated. The point is, we've seen this before, so I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it. The point is to recognize the difference of domains and procedure, but also their complementarity. They are the functionally related parts within the single knowledge of a single whole world. So that's my summary in my notes here of what he said about the common sense insights and insights into concrete situations. And that's where Rege and Habermas become important, because Habermas's whole thrust is toward the political discourse and the concrete situations of society. So that's the main point for that. Then he moves in number 19 to scientific judgments. So have we got any more that we want to cover or reflect on what we've said up to this point? Good. This takes us about halfway through chapter 10, and he's moving then into scientific judgments. But what about that? Okay. In the field of empirical science, as at times elsewhere, judgments are probable. So they are not virtually unconditioned. It is not virtually unconditioned even that Galileo's law of falling bodies is true. It's a probable judgment. Highly probable, because it's been verified for how many centuries. But it's still probable. They converge upon true judgments as upon a limit. And the very procedure, I've gone over this with you before, again, to display the logic of scientific procedure, is if A, then B, and then the experiment is done, but B, and all that tells you is therefore possibly A. It doesn't tell you anything more than that. So this is your hypothesis. The hypothesis is A. Let's say that the distance is proportional to the time squared. That's A. All right, if that's the case, then such and such will happen. So you set up your experiment to see whether this happens. If that happens, well, then it says that this is possibly true. It doesn't say it's definitely true. So that's the structure of scientific reasoning. By its structure, it cannot arrive at more than the hypothesis. So they converge upon judgments as upon a limit. And so again, it's highly probable, because it's been used over and over and over again in all kinds of other scientific work. But it's not virtually grasped and virtually unconditioned. The structure of scientific experimentation does not get to the truth. It gets to the best available scientific opinion of the day. We seek the truth because we do not know it. Now, this is the whole business about what he means by probable. What do you mean when you say a scientific judgment is probable? We seek the truth because we do not know it. But though we do not know it, still, we can recognize it when we reach it. And in like manner, we also are able to recognize when we're getting near it. A strange thing. Plato asks the question, how is it that I know when I'm getting close to what I didn't know? Isn't that strange? that I know that I'm on the hunt and I'm getting close to it. How is it that I can know that? It's because of the converging evidence. We can recognize it when we reach it, and in like manner, we are also able to recognize when we're getting near it. The self-correcting process of learning consists in a sequence of questions, insights, further questions, further insights, that moves towards a limit in which no further pertinent questions arise. When we're well beyond that limit, judgments are obviously certain. When we're well short of that limit, judgments are at best probable. When we're on the borderline, the rash are completely certain and the indecisive are full of doubts. In brief, because the self-correcting process of learning is an approach to a limit of no further pertinent questions, there are probable judgments that are probably true in the sense that they approximate to a truth that as yet is not known. And in science, the generalization of classical laws is no more than probable. The laws themselves are no more than probable, and their generalization is no more than probable, because the application of single laws raises further questions that lead towards the systematization of a whole field. And that's a long-term process. In turn, such systematization is no more than probable until the limit of no further pertinent question is reached. And when will we be there? Probably in the eschaton. But that limit is not reached, first, if there may be further unknown facts that would raise further questions to force a revision. Scientists know that that's always the case. Or secondly, if there may be further unknown facts whose capacity to raise such further questions is not grasped. The generalization also of statistical laws is also no more than probable, since they presuppose some classification of events, scientific classification. And definitive classification can't be had if classical generalizations are only probable. Nonetheless, empirical science is truly probable. It probably is true that the distance is proportional to the time squared. It probably is true that energy is mass times the square of the speed of light. Because it's been verified over and over again, the conditions are such that the scientists, they know they're on the hunt and close to it with those. They can use those formulae satisfactorily in further experimentation and so on. So it's converging upon truth, approaching the limit. But it's not true that all judgment is like that. Some people will say, well, science is our best form of knowing, and if that's only probable, then all knowing is only probable. No, something happened. That's more than probable. That judgment is more than probable. And finally, there's the business of analytic judgments, and I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail because I think it's better to postpone this till we see a couple of instances of it. But analytic, Lonergan distinguishes a lot of contemporary logic and some linguistic analysis, but it's mostly mathematical logic that makes a big thing of analytic propositions. Analytic propositions are propositions where they're internally defined, they're internally, the criterion is the internal consistency based on the definition of the terms. So it's almost like Gertrude Stein's a rose is a rose. Well, I mean, that is true. It is true, but not much of a problem. He discusses both analytic propositions and analytic principles. In analytic propositions, a formal term of meaning provides the condition. The definitions of its partial terms provide the fulfilling conditions, and the rules of meaning provide the link between the conditions and the conditioned. I really want to come back to this when we actually see one in action in his book. But the important distinction that he makes, and I haven't seen it in logicians, is to distinguish an analytic proposition from an analytic principle. An analytic proposition is just a logical creation. But an analytic principle is an analytic proposition whose partial terms are existential. That is, they occur in their defined sense in judgments of fact. And we will see that in his actual deduction of what I did very quickly here before about experience, understanding, judging, potency, form, act. That's a set of analytic principles, and that's what I'm waiting for that, because that will show us the significance of these judgments, and it will show it in a way that here it's quite abstract, but it will be quite concrete when we get to that. So I'm just saying, if you will be patient with me on this, I doubt that analytic propositions are at the forefront of anybody's consciousness here, but their significance is best postponed until we actually come across one in the course of the book. And that will be in the discussion of isomorphism. The isomorphism between the knowing and the known. Experiencing, understanding, judging is isomorphic importance. That's another question. So, any questions? Anything that we need to ask this?
Just a comment. It seems, on the face of it, a little odd when you think about all the technology that's been derived from science, that their judgments are ultimately just problematic. It's just a...
Well, it's the structure. No scientist who's really reflected on scientific method will... When Lonergan's... discusses the distinction, the difference between Aristotle's notion of science and modern science. For Aristotle, science was the certain knowledge of things through their causes. For the modern scientist, science is not certain. It isn't. And it's not through causes in the sense of efficient, final, material, formal cause, as it was for Aristotle. Nor is it necessary. Kant was still working under the illusion that it was still the general mindset that knowledge was universal and necessary and certain. But it isn't. Modern science is not. It's not necessary. It's just what happens to be. And it's not certain. And it's the best available scientific opinion of the day. And that structure of scientific, this is the logic of scientific verification. It does not arrive at certainty. The concluding judgment is not a certain judgment. It's only a possible judgment. If it were the other way around, if A then B, but A then B, yeah, that's. But if this way, then B, well, that there could be many other explanations for B besides that law, and they know that. So all that is. All that scientific verification does is not falsify the hypothesis. It doesn't do more than Popper is good on that. I think Karl Popper. And in chapter 11, we will see that the primitive terms of science. Mass, right now, for instance, the notion of mass is regarded as a relatively primitive term, but it could shift. Its significance could shift with further discoveries. There could be something that is more basic, and it could move the notion of mass into a subordinate place. And so there's proleptic, or sort of putting off the final conclusions. And you wonder, you know, Hawking's thing about the field theory, whether that's going to come as quickly as he hopes it might. Because then you'd have the primitive terms fixed once and for all. And I don't think they're ready to claim that. Yes, Hans?
I think what you've heard here, certainly the latter part, is what I've experienced in my professional life in the scientific community, that true scientists are always using that kind of language. A good example is climate change, for instance. If you go into the scientific community, the dialogue, the conversation is always in probability, most likely, that's the best we understand. It's when it gets to the political level that it becomes certainty for somebody's purpose. And that creates a tremendous amount of tension between the scientific community, and that's a global community. There's a tremendous amount of dialogue and cooperation that takes place. But it's always at that level. It's always couched in language like that. It's the best we understand. It's possible. It's a high probability. You know, the results show, etc., whatever it is. But it never comes out as a certainty. And it's unfortunate that when we read about it, often it's gone through a filter, and it comes out as, you know, it's happening.
One way or the other, it's happening,
yeah,
or it isn't.
Yeah, you know what I mean, because it's used. I have colleagues who continually have that problem, because when that stuff comes out of the scientific community, certainly at the government level, it's filtered through the Prime Minister's office.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it gets out into that level, it gets translated into it's happening.
Any other comment on
that? No, I have a different comment.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yes.
If I'm just trying to think about the relationship between the different types of knowing, between common sense and science, and if you never know anything with certainty in science, it's always probabilistic, then can you rely on science to determine when there are no more questions to ask? I mean, how do you, when can you, right, you then you, right, so you can't use science to learn anything that's not probable, that's true. So you can learn some things that are true from common sense, not necessarily common sense, but you can't from science.
Well, you can, I mean, there's some things that scientists can tell you. I mean, when you do this with a cyclotron, this will happen, and so on. Those are true judgments.
Yeah.
But the laws that are derived from scientific investigation and then confirmed in scientific, the procedure of scientific experimentation and verification and confirmation,
mm-hmm.
by its very logic, cannot move beyond probability.
Sure, and that's fine, but I'm just going back to the problem, of knowing when you've asked enough questions,
yeah.
to know that something is really true.
Yeah.
Then what do you really have to rely on to know that you've asked enough questions?
You.
Okay.
That's what.
And that's what makes you authentic. But
that's
a lot of, what you have, this goes back to, what do you mean you? A lot of what I have, you, apart from my common sense, my common sense and your common sense and everybody else's common sense, they're not really common.
Right.
So I suppose that maybe if we had a complete list of these, of the cognitional operations, right? So I can trust that I have this cognitional operation that lets me to determine change. So fine, I know something happens. Now, the next question I'm going to do, what happened?
That's right.
How am I ever going to answer that question? I guess I don't. I can't answer that question. I can't answer.
Oh, you
answer
can
certain.
Answer that, but it will take further investigation before you can answer. I mean, you can determine whether it was a fire or a leak, you know, that caused it. But it's not. You don't know that right away. You know?
No, I understand.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna start relying. I'm gonna start bringing in either common sense or science or something.
Well, They'll all help get you there. But you may, at the end of the process, you may say, well, I'm not quite sure how this happened,
mm-hmm.
but this is what it seems to be. And you can rely on that. I mean, that may be in a given instance as far as you can go.
Mm-hmm.
But we have nothing but. This is one of the things in Lonergan, and it scares a lot of people about what he's saying. But we don't have anything but ourselves at our best in community with one another. We have nothing more. That's it. Sean.
Part of Thomas Kuhn's theory, and I think it might be helpful to what you're getting at, is, you know, at some point, once all the questions are answered, it stops becoming science, and it becomes, say, engineering or something like that.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, it's in the anomalies that science really exists. But once the questions are answered, it's no longer science. It becomes application. It becomes engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's maybe one way to think about when are all the questions answered? You know, again, still probable or possible. I mean, there are other.
I think it
probable.
Is still, because I know, at least in terms, at least for Lonergan, it would still be, because he says that the two theories of relativity, one of them is more probable than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which is the one that's been more verified than the other one, but with neither one of them is he saying that all the questions are in, or all the questions have been answered.
But until at least for Kuhn, until anomalies start popping up in the theory, then it's really not science anymore. It's just engineering or something
all
else.
All right, that does make sense. That does make sense. And there can be, so then that's a relative. It's a relative notion then of when the questions have been answered. The questions have been answered in something that's as complex as scientific matters. Well, all the questions have been answered up to now, and we can't think of any more right now, but there may emerge further questions.
Right.
The same thing is true in historical studies, and in hermeneutics and interpreting texts, but Lonergan's historical method, which he doesn't give us much of an insight, but spells out in excruciating detail in Method and Theology, the same thing will be the case. When do you arrive at a historical judgment that you know is going to last forever? Very rarely, you know. He gives, I think I mentioned this last week, but the example of, well, we may not ever have any further relevant questions about Nero because he's not such a big deal. But Schleiermacher and Lucy or somebody else, there will always be new questions, and there will probably always be a cover of new things. And every time you read this book, I mean, I find something new that I didn't see before. So there's always something new, not because it wasn't there before, but I just didn't get it. I didn't see that word's a nuance that I didn't recognize before. So that influences your interpretation and it goes on. All right, so next week then we will do what was originally scheduled for this week, chapter 11, the subpopulation. Is there anything else?